course of probably over the course of months, unless for some miracle it settles early, is the U.S. government accusing Google of illegally protecting its own monopoly. This is going to be a fairly important, an incredibly important antitrust case along the lines of when the federal government went after Microsoft for the same things in the 1990s, for having so much market share and having a platform that was required for everyone else to use that it essentially carved competitors right out of business. And if you think about Google, which also includes YouTube and Google Maps and a variety of other things, it's very difficult to escape Google. And in fact, a while back, we interviewed Kashmir Hill. She was then with Gizmodo, now with the New York Times, about trying to detach yourselves from the big tech companies, from Apple, from Google, from Amazon, from Microsoft. And she found it was incredibly difficult to do because you don't even know sometimes when you're using those services on the back end of some other service that you're using. For example, if you were to buy a transit pass with the BART system in the Bay Area, which she was talking about, that operates on a Microsoft platform. So it's very, very difficult to escape these things. So right now, the federal government is going after Google for illegally, this is according to the New York Times, illegally protecting its monopoly over search and search advertising. This is the government's, as the New York Times describes it, the most significant challenge to the tech company's market power in a generation, and one that could reshape the way consumers use the internet. And this is the core of antitrust law. I mean, the antitrust law, which dates back to the 1890s, is simply about creating an environment where one entity does not get such a dominant market position that it destroys competition. And the key about destroying competition is that that is not generally considered in the interest of consumers. And that's sort of where the rubber meets the road in terms of antitrust law. Are the consumers being protected? But before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about the reaction to this lawsuit. So Expedia, local company Expedia, its CEO was on the, was a participant in the GeekWire Summit. So how do other companies feel about this lawsuit? Well, let's just turn to Expedia Group CEO, Peter Kern. He attended the virtual GeekWire Summit this week, and he weighed in specifically today on the lawsuit, and he feels like it's a pretty good thing.
In general, we favor the governments of the world looking at Google. We think many of their practices have not been good for us and have disadvantaged us and others like us, not even in our industry. So we think it's a healthy thing. Our chairman has been very outspoken on the topic, and I think it is good that the government has finally taken it up, that the European Union has taken it up, that state AGs have taken it up, et cetera. So I think it's all positive. I hope it changes behavior at Google. But as you say, I've also said we've got to, you know, Google is what Google is until it's something different. And we've got to play by the rules of the game as they exist. So we always have to do what we have to do to optimize against, you know, the rules of the game. But I'm very pleased to see the government finally taking some action, and hopefully it will create a fairer marketplace for us, which is all we want. We have no axe to grind against Google, except that we don't think the marketplace is equitable. So that is all we want. Whether that's hurt us and whether we've been damaged by it over the past however many years is a different discussion, but you know, we want a fair playing field, and we think we'll win in a fair playing field, and that's what we're looking for.
So what is and again, that was Peter Kern. He is the CEO of the Expedia Group, the travel service. They're now based in what used to be the Amgen campus here in Seattle. And what is his objection? Well, his objection is this, and this is sort of the core of the government's objection as well. Does, if you are creating a platform for other people to sell stuff, for example, Google's, you know, web search, if you're on Google, that is one thing, and you are providing a, Google's providing a platform for these companies to be searched for on the internet, found, and to be able to other people to be able to purchase, you know, stuff on Expedia. But Google, and this has also been the core of the challenge against Amazon as well, when Amazon has faced the same sort of antitrust concerns, it has been, well, all right, that's fine. You've created a platform for us. But then you decided to actually operate your own competitive business on that platform and optimize your web environment. In other words, build all the roads to go first to your product before it goes to ours, after we have become locked in on using your product. And this is where the antitrust argument begins to take shape. To get to the origins of the Antitrust Act, it starts with the U.S. railroad companies. In the 1880s, there was all kinds of tiny railroads all over the country, railroads that ran short spurs between cities, between a big city and a scattering of small cities. There were little railroads everywhere. The government was actually offering incentives for people to set up railroads because it wanted to essentially lace the country with railroads, both to move product and to move people. But then the railroads started getting purchased by individual groups, to the point that most of the railroads were being owned by very, very few people. There was a senator named John Sherman. If you've ever heard of the Sherman Antitrust Act, this is the guy who wrote it and where it started. And his quote is, if we will not endure a king as a political power, we should not endure a king over the production, transportation, and sale of any of the necessaries of life. So Congress passed the Sherman Antitrust Act almost unanimously in 1890. And the thing about the Sherman Antitrust Act is it's still essentially the core of antitrust law in the United States. It essentially says we do not want to do something that actually allows one person to own a market to the detriment of the people who want to purchase in that market. But there's also where antitrust law has sometimes fallen short on internet products, and it would be this. For example, what does it cost you to use Google? Well, virtually nothing. You do have to pay for your internet service, and you do have to pay for, I suppose, your laptop or your cell phone, whatever you're using to surf on the web, but your actual use of Google is free, or sort of free. I mean, as an aside, what you are providing Google with is all kinds of your own personal data, which then Google turns into money by farming it out to ad companies and other companies so they can know who you are and what you search for and how they can better sell products to you. I mean, effectively with Google, Google is not the product, you are the product. But that is also how Google would tell you that you get it for free, because we just want to take a little, you know, a little bit of our pound of flesh to get it back. But we're not actually charging you anything in terms of money for that. So this has always been the defense. Are you really hurting consumers if, in fact, consumers are able to access Facebook for free and Google for free, and except for buying things, Amazon for free and other things like that? And the answer always has been, well, I guess if it's free, you don't have that one leg of the stool that you need, which is consumers have to be harmed. Are they harmed in this case? Well, it's made a turn, though. When Google got big enough to be this platform, not unlike Amazon and its third-party sellers, when Google got big enough to be this platform, that's when companies started complaining, like, hey, wait a minute, you know, when Expedia gets angry about this, Expedia is angry specifically about the fact that Google has decided to set up its own businesses right in what Expedia thought of as its own territory within Google. Expedia was happy to compete with Kayak and other online travel agencies. It never had a problem with that. If they all had access to Google, great. But when Google decided to allow itself to do these sort of same sales and then allow its search engine, which it controls, to find its own products first, this is when all of those companies began having some difficulty with it. So this is from the GeekWire story with the Expedia CEO. A recent House Judiciary Committee antitrust report quoted an anonymous market participant saying that Google, quote, deceptively siphons internet traffic away from its other competitors in online travel and forces them to pay more in ads in order to get meaningful placement on Google's search engine results. It's essentially Google requiring companies to pay to just match Google's own ability to place its own ad. So Google will accelerate your capacity to find a Google ad. And then if you want equal, you have to buy your way into that new accelerated platform, which is you don't have much of a choice, do you, if you're using Google's platform to sell things. Quote, it requires vertical competitors to provide their inventory feed to populate the ads, allowing Google to appropriate vertical service providers' inventory data. In other words, not only do you have to pay to compete with Google in its own space, you also have to give up your own, essentially your own trade secrets, your own pricing, all of your information, so Google can also compete against that. And this is what Kern had to say, the CEO of Expedia. He said, I think there's definitely truth in those statements when he's asked about that. This is by, again, a story, really terrific story, Todd Bishop in GeekWire. Google would say that they're doing what the consumer wants. That's what they always tell us. It makes a better auction or it makes better information, but we take a different view. They're inevitably, through their tier practices, making it harder for people who have paid to give them the right to keep making it harder for us. So in other words, if we pay them, we can find some way to maybe even it out, but they keep ratcheting it. They keep changing what the target is and siphoning money from us, which then, of course, forces a company like Expedia to charge more to be able to stay within Google's environment. And thus, it is actually not helping the competitors. So where does Google stand on all of this? Well, the attorneys for Google have essentially, you know, poo-pooed the lawsuits. Google has said that they're not in any way valid. It denies the antitrust accusations of antitrust violations, and the company has pretty deep pockets. Alphabet, which is Google's parent company, is valued at $1 trillion, and it's got, according to the New York Times, $120 billion of cash reserves. And it's also fought these sort of lawsuits in Europe. The Europeans have been much more exacting on antitrust violations when it comes to Facebook, when it comes to Amazon, and when it comes to Google, among others. And Google also spent a whole bunch of money, although it's spent about $12 million lobbying in the United States, which actually, to me, sounds a little bit on the low side. It is willing to dole out cash to get its point made in Congress, but Google is also facing a bit of bipartisan unity on the on its level of power. Now, Google would also say, as the company's chief legal officer has said, it can't be an antitrust violation for this reason. People use Google because they choose to, not because they're forced to, or because they can't find an alternative. And that has always been kind of the core. When Standard Oil was owning all of the petroleum reserves, or much of the petroleum reserves in the United States, you could legitimately make an argument that you had to go through Standard, or a market that Standard completely controlled. The rail barons were much in the same way, and that's, again, sort of was the core of the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890. Those are the sort of things. When Microsoft was in something like 85-90% of government computers, and Windows became the platform virtually every school, with some exceptions, and every government was using, and then Google decided, hey, we don't want to play with Netscape anymore. We'd rather use our own browser. We'd rather not play with these other companies. That's what was the core of the lawsuits against Microsoft, because its market share had grown so big. Google is making the claim that it isn't. Now, I don't know about you folks. I know that when your name becomes synonymous with searching, in other words, just Google it, it seems to me like you've established yourself at least in a dominant market position. I mean, we all know how often we search on Yahoo, or how often we search on Bing, how often we search on, well, I don't even know what else is out there to search on. And some of those things actually still are using Google algorithms to get to do searching. I think it's very difficult for Google to say that it is not dominant, it certainly in search. The question remains, though, whether or not that dominance is actually bad for the consumer. But it certainly is, if you were to buy into the fact that it's bad for other businesses, I think that they've, you know, most of the businesses that are finding themselves now competing with Google would say the same thing that the businesses, the third-party sellers that are competing with Amazon would have said, that you essentially watched us, you collected our data, you gave us a platform to start selling stuff, you very closely tracked our selling data, and then you essentially just built a clone business and undercut us. And then, because you control the actual store, you put your products in a better place than you put ours. And that's been the claim against Amazon by some third-party sellers, and that is similar to what the claim is against Google right now. And so this is going to be... it's hard to stress this too much. I think this is going to be a real game changer for how all of us use the internet, because there is, it's hard to be much more omnipotent than Google. I mean, I've got Chrome browser up on my screen as we speak. It's also the one I use in my phone. I do use, like you probably do, YouTube pretty regularly. I am using Gmail right just before recording this segment. I was using it earlier than half an hour ago to search for something else that I needed. I mean, it's hard. It would be difficult for me to think of anything that I interact with more. I mean, I use Apple products, right? And I also use you know, other PC-based products, but mostly I use Apple products. But even with that, even on all of those products, regardless of whether it's a PC product or an Apple product or something else, I still end up sort of routed back into frequent use of Google when it comes to email and things like that. And so I don't know how Google can not be considered, at least to some degree, owning a major market share. It's whether or not that is good for me, because what also is true, and it's true for you as well, unless you're buying some sort of enhanced business services, you're probably not paying anything for it. And I'm not either. And I've made this sort of deal in my head that, well, I'll try to at least to some degree control how much of my data you get. But the fact is they have all of it, right? And I'll try to mitigate how much I am buying stuff from, say, Google's marketplace. I mean, I tend to use Google to buy from somebody else, but you know what happens is I'm on Google and I use Google to get to Amazon, and then I buy something from Amazon. So it's not like I'm shedding myself of any sort of monopoly environment for the bulk of my purchases. And so we'll see where this goes. And what is the other side of, say, the government winning a case or winning some sort of like breaking up of Google in an antitrust lawsuit? I mean, are we going to benefit? Are we going to benefit from a variety of platforms, emails, some charging, some not, an internet in Discord? Because the good thing about Google, I guess, is that it's sort of made everything, it's kind of collected everything in a way that's easy for us, and we don't have to jump from system to system to system to be able to use it. The downside, of course, being that because of this, we are fully dependent on it, and that is, again, where antitrust law, where the rubber meets the road. This story is going to get increasingly interesting as it moves through. All right, coming up next, we are going to be talking with, at the top of the hour, of course, we've got Stacey Joe. We're going to maybe take a break from football this time. We got plenty of football to talk about in the next couple of days. Maybe, I don't know, I was thinking about asking her about television. She and Aaron used to talk a ton about their favorite television shows, and I got a couple that I'm going to advocate for, so maybe we'll talk a bit about that and a few other things. And then also, of course, right at the immediate turn, Random Question Robot, right after the break. Little Eminem, that's nice. There's just so little Eminem we can actually play on the air, though, you know?
Ain't that the truth,
right? So, I was going to talk... I've got a story to talk about. It's actually a pretty interesting one, but I'm looking at Twitter during the commercial break, and my old boss at Fred Hutch had tweeted out something. She's watching the World Series. She is living down in Los Angeles right now, and she tweeted out something about what is a Mookie Betts and can we get one in Seattle? And of course, Mookie Betts is he was a star with the Red Sox, got signed to this massive contract, with the Los Angeles Dodgers. And apparently, I haven't watched the game, so I'm not, sorry if I'm spoiling anything. If I am, turn it off, turn me off, if you haven't already, because I'm going to talk a little bit about the game, although I don't actually know what the score is. But she brings up the fact that why don't we have a Mookie Betts here in Seattle? It's a good question. I can't actually answer that. But I can built her a bridge from Mookie Betts to Seattle. And here's what it is. So Mookie Betts, player for the Dodgers, fantastic player. One of the best players in baseball. There are days where he may be the best player in baseball. Is named after Mookie Blaylock, the basketball player. Mookie Blaylock was the original name of Pearl Jam, and the album 10 is Mookie Blaylock's number. So what I was trying to explain to her, like, look, he practically is Seattle, given that he was named after somebody who a local band was named after, and a local band of ours, maybe one of the most famous local bands other than Nirvana, actually had an album that was his number. The other thing about Mookie Blaylock, which actually all of us should be a fan of at this particular point, is that apparently he stole a base in the World Series tonight. And that is, according to Taco Bell, steal a base, steal a taco promotion. Everyone in the country qualifies for a free, I think that maybe the Doritos taco. I'm not sure which taco it is, but you get a free taco now at Taco Bell on October 28th. What taco is it that they're selling? Steal a base, steal a taco. A Doritos Locos taco. You get a free one of those thanks to Mookie Betts. So even if you don't like baseball, even if you don't know who Mookie Blaylock is, and you don't really enjoy Pearl Jam, you still get a taco on October 28th for free if you show up at a Taco Bell. Now, what I was going to talk about, which is much less interesting to me than Mookie Betts, was the fact that this is an odd thing. Researchers don't just study medicine and treatment when you get into the healthcare system. They also study placebos. And according to a study, a groundbreaking study, initially done by Harvard and then duplicated recently, it turns out that not only, and we all kind of know this, that placebos can have a dramatic effect. In fact, in many cases, a placebo can have the same effect on somebody as a medicine, if they believe it is the medicine. In other words, we've always talked about the power of being able to change your mind to believe in your body's ability to heal itself, and it actually seems to have a legitimate medical connection. But here somebody did a pretty smart study about what if you know it's a placebo, and it turns out that also seems to have some help, and people actually are reporting like they feel better, even though it was just a saline spray or a sugar pill or something along those lines. This is a study. Also, it was a duplicate study, and actually letting people know that the placebo, that they're actually taking a placebo, and for some reason, now maybe, I don't know, it didn't say in the story whether or not they didn't know what the word placebo meant, but I'm assuming that they did, and it still seemed to have a good effect on them. So I guess, you know, if you're a believer in the power of positive thinking, it looks like there may be some medical basis on that as well. But the interesting thing about the whole idea of placebos is there is a fair bit of the medical community that does not feel that the use of placebos is actually ethical. And in fact, some ethicists argue that using placebos in clinical trials or prescribing patients a placebo intervention violates the fundamental principles of medicine. This is from Scientific American. Franklin Miller, who is a professor of medical ethics at Weill Cornell Medicine, says this. He said, I'm okay with deception if it's methodologically necessary. In other words, if you need it to get through the experiment to answer a valuable scientific question, he said. But he suggests alerting subjects to the possibility that they will be deceived at some point and obtaining informed consent called, quote, authorized deception, then researchers could get rid of deception altogether. So in other words, he suggests that you need to let people know that a placebo may be used in the event of the clinical trial. And this is an area, this is actually an interesting subject for this area, because this is an area where a tremendous number of clinical trials happen. They happen at the Cancer Care Alliance. They happen at Fred Hutch, is big on specifically as it relates to HIV and as it relates to cancer cures. But in many other places in this area, given the amount of biomedical research that is done in Seattle, this is actually something that I've heard a lot of doctors talk about, because the need for a placebo is really how you can test the efficacy, I guess you will, of a medicine. But there are plenty of people who feel like, well, wait, I'm in a clinical trial. If the placebo is a determining factor on whether or not I'm actually getting treatment, and that treatment is a determining factor whether or not I survive, do I want to be part of the placebo group? And I guess in that particular case, I don't know what the alternative is. I guess you don't enter, an experimental clinical trial. Many people who do, particularly when it comes to cancer medication, have to fit a certain criteria, and they have to be, you know, a certain way down the path. Sometimes people who really don't have any other alternative are the only people accepted into a clinical trial. And so those folks may not have, you know, any good option anyway. And so being a part of the trial, they may actually be advancing research that might not help them, but it might help other people. The interesting thing also about this is that the new study that I was talking about is from the University of Michigan. And when researchers, so it says that when researchers are transparent about placebo use, when they tell people that they're going to use a placebo, they reduce the emotional distress that puts people in an upsetting situation. And then they notice that if they look at the outcomes down the road with whatever it is that they're treating, that there's a weird effect that people, even maybe even being in the placebo, they don't get into a lot of detail psychologically about why this affects people in such a positive way. But maybe it is that they're engaging with the process. Maybe it is that they're involved somehow in something that they feel like will lead to a better outcome for them. They seem to actually get better even with just a placebo. And I'm guessing, and it's not explained well in the story that I'm reading about it, but I'm guessing that it has a lot to do with the situation that they're in. And back to what I was saying earlier about this whole notion of power of positive thinking, if they are actually in a place where they feel like, all right, well, we can at least identify what's wrong, maybe move it ahead, maybe change my outcome, even if it's not on this particular treatment, but some treatment down the road, that ends up being, you know, at least enough to maybe get them over the hump, or to get them feeling a little bit better, or at least maybe get them focusing a little bit less on their symptoms. A doctor once told me, my dad, many, many years ago, died of cancer, but he went through a period where his numbers weren't getting any better, but he was getting a little bit more, we all were getting actually a little more hopeful that it was going, that we turned a corner. It turned out that we hadn't. But even in that period where he felt like he turned a corner, everything about him, like he was feeling not really any better. His numbers were not any better. His white blood cell count, things like that were not any better. But his attitude was a lot better. And it was really kind of a remarkable change, even though medically not a whole lot was happening. Coming up, of course, we've got the random question robot. And we have at the top of the hour, we have Stacey Joe, who is going to be popping in. And we're going to talk almost everything except the Seahawks. So I'm just warning you. Coming up. This is Safety Dance, right?
Yes.
One of my favorite songs. And we can answer, I guess, if we want. Actually, we don't have a choice. We have to answer. We're not allowing anyone to not answer. Not because it's time for the random question robot, the Questrotron 700. I assume Shane is ready because he is, as he says, was born ready. Frank, are you ready?
I'm never ready, but
right.
Okay.
That's that everyone is to type. All right. First question right out of the box. going to go with Frank first this time.
Oh, goody.
Frank, what is the most immature thing that you do?
Now?
Right.
Now?
Yes.
Read funny books. How's that?
Comics?
Comic books.
All right.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Shane?
I definitely still sometimes have the sense of humor of a middle schooler sometimes, so I can't help that.
And for me, I don't know what it would be. I would say, what would be the most immature thing that I still do? I would say the occasional, you know, I think that sometimes in the garage, if I'm working on something and I'm just getting, I get to that like snapping point of being frustrated, I have been known to throw a tool or two.
There you go.
I wouldn't throw it at somebody else, and I wouldn't throw it at anything expensive, but would I huck it out into the yard? Absolutely. And occasionally into the trash can.
Oh.
All right. Next question. Shane, what would be your spirit animal?
My spirit animal. Wow. You know what? I would probably have to say...
Actually, Shane?
Yes.
What would be Frank's spirit animal?
Oh,
good luck with that.
Frank, I think that he would be an owl. He sees all, he knows all. He's just always around, and he's letting us know what's going on from, you know, the big guy in the sky.
And what time does he ply his trade?
Usually at nighttime.
There you go. That's actually a pretty good one. All right, Frank, what's Shane's?
A polar bear.
Really? Why?
Well, for obvious reasons. I mean, it's all about the snow, as is he.
Yeah, fair enough. All right. Well, I guess I got to pick my own then.
Yeah,
we need four people to make this actually work a little bit better. I don't know what my spirit animal would be. I mean, I'm guessing. If you pick it yourself, you got to pick something that doesn't seem like. I mean, no one picks lion right for themselves, right? Because then you just come off like a jerk. I don't know what my spirit animal would be. I would, if I were actually a little bit more carefree, I'd probably pick an otter just because I dig otters.
I think that's great.
That was going to be my answer for
myself.
That's
a great choice.
Yeah, otter is always like kind of the perfect spirit animal. It's fierce enough, but mostly has fun and eats, if it's a sea otter, eats a lot of oysters.
Yeah.
but I'm probably more close to, you know, a turtle, I would guess, you know. I would say that's probably a little, like, just a little bit, not very capable, but reasonably durable.
And persistent.
All right, next one. Whoops.
There it is.
And we do have time for one more, right, Shane?
We got time for maybe two more.
All right, great. Ooh, we're going kind of fast to the answers in. Shane, actually, I'll answer this one first. What is the most interesting documentary you've watched? Well, I've been touting The Social Dilemma, which is fantastic.
It is.
It really is. It's worth everyone watching. Please watch it. It's on Netflix. It will tell you more than you want to know about social media and really change your perspective on it. But I have to go back in time. I'm going to have to go with Hoop Dreams, which I still think is one of the, one of the best documentaries I've ever seen, one of the best films. I thought that movie was incredibly moving and really well done, and I don't think you could ever do it again, because I don't think anyone would ever give access like these guys got it for 5 years of filming in this film. Shane?
I would say the documentary Exit Through the Gift Shop, the documentary about the street artist Banksy and
That's supposed to be great.
Yeah, to like graffiti culture and some of the street art scene. Didn't know anything about it, and when I watched it, I've just immediately became obsessed with the dude. I think he's great.
All right, Frank, documentary.
Ken Burns, The Civil War.
That one's a pretty terrific one.
I mean, told me things I didn't know, fascinating stories. I loved every second of it.
All right. We have time for one. Nope.
It sounds one, like, we got one more.
We have time for one more?
Lightning
All right.
round.
All right. Lightning round. All right. Whoa. That one doesn't make any sense at all. It sort of got garbled. There we go. What's the weirdest thing you've seen while driving, Shane?
Oh, wow. Some naked dude get tackled on the beach. I did see that one time in Santa Cruz.
You weren't the naked dude, I assume.
Thankfully not, no.
Okay. Frank?
I watched an older style, like maybe a Chevy, next to me on Highway 12, gradually go off the road and then do a slow roll.
Wow.
Like two or three rolls. really bizarre.
Wow. Yeah. So I have to say, mine was actually while mountain biking, and I'm kind of surprised I didn't bring this up before. I'm mountain biking at a place called Raging River. No, I'm at Doofy on Sunday.
Yeah.
And we're on a trail. We stop, me and three other friends, and we're just standing there talking a little bit before we head down the trail. 50 feet in front of us on the trail that we're on, we hear this crack, and then we look up, and an entire sizable tree comes down on the trail in front of us. Literally, if any of us had been 50 feet further along,
toast.
Dead men. Toast. We would have been pancaked.
Wow.
And that we were just sort of like, well, all right, is that great luck or terrible luck? We don't know. All right, coming up, we've got Stacy Joe, and the conversation is, like I said, everything but the Seahawks, with, of course, a little bit of Seahawks.